of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We're here at early 3:30 start time today. I'm excited to do the show early. We are having New York Times bestselling author Caitlin Rother joining the show in just a couple of moments. I can't wait to talk to her about her brand new book called The No One Can Have Her, which I'm deep into right now. I've been reading it over the last couple of days. She'll be talking about that, and I've got a list a mile long of questions. I can't wait to have her on. But before we bring her on, I'm going to give you the recap for the week so you know what's going on. If you missed last night's show on Monday, we had author Gail Carline on the program. Always a fun time with Gail. Tomorrow on the show at 7 o'clock, we've got psychic and astrologer Zoe Niklaus and Doug Johnston joining the program, taking your calls. You get a twofer. If you call in tomorrow night, the phone line's open at 6:45. You can ask one question, and they will each give you an answer from their respective talent bank. So if you'd like to ask a question about love or your job or your car or your kids or whatever, call in tomorrow night starting at 6:45 for our 90-minute broadcast. On Thursday's Rated LGBT Radio at a special 6:30 start time. We're doing the shows pretty much all over the board this week. We have Rob Watson rejoining the show. We have Jonathan Griffith as our VIP guest star in segment one. He's hosted a talk show out of New York City for the last 20 years. He's going to talk about that. And in the second segment, Mr. Terry Ray, he's been on the show. He's a fan favorite here. But he has a new play out on April 22nd called Electricity. So he's going to give us an update on that on the Friday dance party this Friday afternoon starting at 1:30. Billy Grime is going to be joining us talking about his brand new album in hour number one. And in hour number two, we have DJ Grant Smith from the popular club in West Hollywood called Rage. He's providing a hour-long dance mix. And then on Saturday, Super Gay Radio, we have a 90-minute broadcast featuring Miss Viola and also Mrs. Kasha Davis with, of course, the star of the program, Mr. Paul in Mass. And that's all starting Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Now, today, our guest is, I'm really honored to have her on here. I met her at the SCWA meeting. And if you want to know more about that, you need to talk to me after the show because I will get you totally hooked up. It's here in Orange County. They've got a meeting this coming Saturday. And it's a great place to go network, meet other authors, but then hear tremendous guest speakers like Caitlin Rother, who's joining us here today. She has been a Pulitzer-nominated staff writer for the San Diego Union-Tribune. She's been published in Cosmo, LA Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and Boston Globe, Daily Beast, Huffington Post. She's been on over 100 TV and radio programs, including Nancy Grace, Women Who Kill on E!, and then also Snapped. She's been heard on Discovery, C-SPAN, XM Radio, and various PBS affiliates. I'm out of breath. And so now I want to say, Caitlin Rother, welcome to Rated G Radio. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on.
Can I tell you what a treat this is for me? I'm a little verklempt because you're what I call a guilty pleasure in having somebody who I really admire come on the program and then talk about your work.
That's so nice.
We met at the SCWA meeting, I was going to say probably like 2 or 3 months back. And I said, boy, this would be like a real get if we could have you to come on the program and talk. So for everybody who's hearing your voice and your name for the first time today, number one, shame on you. You should know Caitlin, and she should be a household name for you by this point. But can you tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you came to be this great murder mystery writer?
People who are living in Orange County might remember a couple of the cases I've written about that maybe we could start there.
Sure.
The Skylar DeLeon, Jennifer DeLeon case, those were the people who were the Bonnie and Clyde of Orange County, basically this horrendous, brutal murder of Tom and Jackie Hawks, who were tied to the anchor of their yacht and thrown overboard off Newport Beach. And it was in the Orange County Register and in the media for several years. There were three trials. I came to all three, and I ended up writing a book called Dead Reckoning. Another case from Orange County, which I wrote a book about, was the Bill McLaughlin murder, also from Newport Beach. This was a cold case murder from 1994. He met this woman who has several last names by now, Nanette Johnston Packard, and I can't even remember her last name, final husband's name. She didn't take it, but Nanette Packard is pretty much how she's known. She advertised for wealthy men only. I'll take care of you if you take care of me. And poor Bill McLaughlin, who was recently divorced, decided to answer this ad. 4 years later, she took care of him, all right. She had her lover shoot him in the head 6 times. So that was Eric Naposky, and that was my book, I'll Take Care of You. So those are two of my recent books, and the one that you mentioned, Then No One Can Have Her, is my 10th book. I was a newspaper reporter, daily newspaper reporter, for 19 years before I quit to write books full time. We had the implosion of the publishing world, both in the news media and in the book publishing. And so now what I do is a whole bunch of things. So I am still a full-time author, but I also am a writing coach and teacher and speaker and TV commentator, and I help other people pursue their dreams to write their first book, and that is actually really a pretty fulfilling part of my life. I'm still working on my own project, but that's more of how I'm making my living these days, because books, they don't pay as much as people might think they do. So I still enjoy all of those things, and it gives me a lot of variety, and it gives me time to come on shows like yours, which is great.
Well, and you know, and I think one of the things that I loved most about your talk at SCWA was the fact that you spoke in depth about the business of writing books versus just, you know, how glamorous it is that you've got 10 best-selling books that are out there. But the realities of the publishing world today, and I think this strikes true for the music business or even, you know, TV and film, where, you know, people think, oh, you know, Caitlin's a writer. She must be raking in trillions of dollars and, you know, just burning $100 bills to keep warm. But what's the reality for even a best-selling author today? Can you help shatter some of the myths that are out there?
Well, because we're going through a transition period right now because of Amazon and because of people who've said, oh, I can self-publish now. I can just hit a button. The market is just glutted with a lot of people who are not professional writers. They are people who are what I would call probably hobbyists. You know, they say, oh, I want to write a book. I can write a book. And they do by pressing a button. But they haven't studied their craft, and they aren't experts in anything. They just got a whim and they wanted to write something. And that's fine. But the problem is readers are now overwhelmed with choices. And so what ends up happening is you have a whole bunch of people who are selling their books on Amazon for 99 cents, who are best-selling authors, quote unquote, who really, you know, it's all about on Amazon. And people like me, who are professional writers, professional journalists, investigative reporters who have worked in the business for many years, we're in the mix too, but it's just like a big loud roar of voices. And I think in time that will settle out, but for the last few years, partly because, you know, bookstores have closed, you know, journalism these days and online content, you know, real journalism, watchdog journalism, investigative journalism, it's expensive. We've just been in a kind of a narrowing. And I think you're seeing evidence of what the result of that is in our presidential race.
I can say it.
And, you know, it's like, let's follow the brightest light and the loudest, most obnoxious thing that is making everybody upset or is on fire. And we're missing real information, and we're missing, and I think, I'm hoping people are, there's going to be a boomerang effect, and that people are going to start saying, you know, I really want a credible, legitimate journalist and author. I want to read one of their books, which I at least know is true and is well-written and doesn't have a bunch of grammatical mistakes. But I think we're in a little bit of a shaking out period, and I'm hoping to come out of it and still be writing books, but it's just difficult because, you know, going to ebooks, going with all the news, going to the internet, you know, what I do has been devalued, and not just me, but, you know, all writers
all creatives.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So let me, can I ask you, do you give any thought to how the world's changed since we were kids, when really the only time you ever went to get a book was to the public library? And something happened, and there was the advent of the Bookstar or Barnes and Noble or any of the other chains that came along, and the libraries kind of got kicked to the curb, and then the mom and pop bookstores kind of got kicked to the curb with the big box booksellers, and now they're going away. But now Amazon is even coming out with bookstores. I think even down in San Diego, down in your neck of the woods, where they're coming out with brick and mortar. What's your take on how the industry has changed? Really from we're just grateful to even hold a copy of a book to I'll go get 20 e-copies of whatever today, and maybe I'll do something with it.
Wow, I could spend like 3 hours answering that question.
Oh.
So let me see if I can pick a part of it to answer.
Any part you want.
Start,
yeah.
Let's start with what happened to bookstores and libraries. It's all part of this, globalization, and the big media companies are buying and gobbling up the little ones. Same thing in the media, same thing with TV stations, same thing with radio stations, same things with book publishers. I mean, it's basically across the board, right? And we're seeing it, these bigger and bigger companies are buying up everything, and that's cutting our information sources down to fewer and fewer sources, which I don't think is good for anyone. But basically, same thing with bookstores, same thing, Amazon is basically gobbling up lots and lots of different types of things, and they're all bringing it under one roof. And so what we end up having is the bigger authors, the biggest authors, the ones who are already, these are the ones who really are making a lot of money. What's his name? I hate it when this happens. The guy who actually pays other people and
James Patterson.
Thank you, James Patterson. Who actually is doing other things, I think, that are good, but I'm just using him as an example because I think he's, probably very wealthy and good at what he does. But when you have those giant names, those people are making money, but everybody like me kind of disappears into the mid-list. The libraries, I think, end up stocking the bigger books. The few bookstores that are left will stock the bigger authors with their books, face covers facing out. And what that means is there's not really a place for people to go and browse anymore and discover the authors who are not as established, do not sell millions of copies of books. And personally, I always liked going to the library. I just came from the library, actually. I was working there today. I still go to the library. I actually give workshops, teen workshops, teen writing workshops, and adult writing workshops. They've used me as a way to get people to come to the library, and they pay me to give a workshop, which the people who come get for free, but it brings people back into the library. And so they're looking for more and different ways to get people to come back, because a lot of people who come to the library come to use the computer, right? They don't have a computer at home. So everything has shifted. And it's continuing to shift. And I am one of the questions that you sent me to kind of think about what we were going to talk about. One of the biggest challenges I face is having to constantly ride this roller coaster of the evolving publishing landscape. I mean, it's a job just to keep up with what's going on in the trends and I try to stay on top of it, but I'm still always some steps behind and trying to learn about things. And, one minute you learn it and the next thing it's changed. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's a great answer because, I guess, a follow-up would be like, because you do this, but how do you stay relevant in a world that is changing and doesn't really seem to want to give out any kind of rule book? It's just like, we're going to be doing this the way we want. And, good luck to you if you happen to come along for the ride.
You have to keep your eyes and ears open every minute. And what I do, this is how I start my day. The minute I wake up, I go get my phone and I sit down and I read. And that's pretty much what I do for an hour, maybe an hour and a half. And I'm just reading. I am reading articles by experts about what's going on in publishing. I am reading actual news articles because I need to be following cases that I might want to write about. I need to be you know, sharing stories and being relevant on social media. And I do mostly Facebook, but I also do Twitter. I do Pinterest. I do Instagram. I do occasionally still do LinkedIn. But, I mean, I actually give seminars on author branding and promotion and building platforms. And this is the kind of stuff that I talk about. Before you even go try to find an agent, you have got to be establishing your own online presence. You've got to be building your own brand from the very start. Even before you even, you know, finish a book, you should already be working on this. And people don't understand this. I give these workshops, I start telling people this, and you should see their faces. The room goes silent, and they're like, oh, my God, I had no idea. And I'm going, don't get scared. Don't get overwhelmed. You
right.
just have to chip away at it. You know, you got to build yourself a website. You got to get on Facebook today. Go home. Make yourself an account. But I don't want to be a public person. Well, then you can't be an author because you have to, in order to be heard above all that noise I was talking about, in order to stay relevant, in order to be somebody that continues to draw readers and continues to be a good person that, I mean, it has to do with whether people like you, unfortunately.
Yeah, totally.
Right? You're building communities, helping, networking, and, you know, even posting articles that are relevant to other people. I got a really nice compliment the other day. This guy who I, you know, met on Facebook, he said to me, you know, you share the greatest articles. I mean, I don't even read them anymore. I just immediately share them because you are 100% right on the money. And I'm like, wow, thank you. So I try to pick things, you know, and not a lot. I don't overpost, but I try to pick articles that I think are helpful to my coaching clients, to other aspiring writers, because I speak at conferences too, and build communities that way. And I'm just always on the lookout for things that are helpful to me, helpful to other people, things that are, you know, interesting stories. I also, you know, try to eat healthy, and I sometimes post warning things about, you know, olive oil that's fake or, you know, whatever else, because I was an investigative reporter and I still have some of that. I try to stay away from politics for the most part, because even when I think I'm not posting something that's going to be offensive to someone, somebody still gets offended. So that's a
Isn't
hard
that
thing.
Crazy?
So, it is
how
crazy
do you get involved in?
Everybody cares so much about politics, and yet, you know, no matter what you do, even if you don't make a comment, even if you just post an article, they think you have an opinion, and it's just like, wow, okay.
It's tough. You know, it's funny because social media is a wonderful thing for, I think, a
right.
lot of people, and then I think other people, they've just taken it a little too far. So,
you know, and it also, you know, sometimes I kind of wonder, why do I have all this stuff in my news feed? So
how do you, as a media personality yourself, how do you manage to navigate this world of social media so you can stay positive and upbeat and motivating, not only to yourself, but to other people, to get those great compliments that I just share your posts because they're great?
Well, I try to not share a lot of negative stuff. I mean, I don't share personal negative stuff, you know, unless I think it might help somebody else. You know, if I go through something that is personal but and traumatic or whatever, I mean, I don't post it in a way that's like, boo-hoo, wham, me, poor me.
Right.
I try to do it in a way that is a lesson or is inspirational or, you know, just something that other people will want to read, because I don't want to be one of those downer people that sometimes you see on social media and you kind of go, unfollow. You know?
Right. Well, and as a public figure that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you are a brand, you are your own empire, and you are there to move some merchandise at some point. And, you know,
right.
people don't want to buy from people who are like, oh, there's that Caitlin. We, you know, just
right.
pass on that one. We need to be
right.
engaging. So having the feedback that you're getting is great. When did you decide that you wanted to be an investigative reporter? I am fascinated by that for anyone who wants to do that, because I am so at the surface that it's like, oh, okay, that's great. You're a writer. Next. And how do you decide at such an early age that this is going to be the career you're going to pursue for 19 years?
Well, when I was in college, I was at UC Berkeley. I kind of didn't really know what I was going to be. I was thinking about being a therapist. So I thought I was a psychology major, and I thought, well, am really interested in mental illness, and I was studying that. And then I thought, you know what? I don't think I can handle listening to people's problems all day. I've got enough of my own problems. I won't have to listen to that all day. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? You know, when I was in elementary school, I always thought I wanted to be a teacher, which is kind of funny because now I am a teacher. I remember I'm in the fourth grade, and I always, you know, I wanted to teach third grade. I get in the fifth grade, I wanted to be a fourth grade teacher. So it's kind of like that. And I get to college, I still don't really know what I want to be. But by the time I'm getting to my senior year, I go, I guess I better decide what I'm going to do with my life. So I went to the Career Center, and I went through all these binders looking for some kind of internship. And the only thing that I could find that I thought was interesting was an internship at KGO Radio in San Francisco, which was talk radio. And I went to work for the Consumer Reporter. And they were basically like a liaison between listeners who were having problems with certain businesses. You know, for example, one of the very first stories that I did, which kind of got me going, and I still remember today, was this little old lady who took her TV to this repair shop, and it had been in the repair shop for a year. This poor woman had nothing to do in her life, but they wouldn't give her TV back. I mean, she basically, they didn't have the part or something. I mean, it was just so sad. And so basically what we did was we basically got in the middle of something like that and helped resolve it and then wrote a story about it if it was relevant. And so I was basically helping, you know, gather information and giving it to the Consumer Reporter, who would then do a 1 minute or, you know, 2 minute spot on some story. And so, you know, I helped get this woman's TV back. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then there was another one where there were, like, I don't even remember, Alaskan oil leases or something. And I got into it, and I started realizing I was really good at this. You connect point A, you go to point B, you go to point C, you go to point D, and then bingo, you've got yourself a story. It was such a rush. And I was just like, wow, this is really cool, and I'm good at it. And I've never found anything to that point. I mean, I was a good writer. I always did well in English and everything, and I was always writing stories and stuff, but I never gave it any kind of thought. I read a million books. Both my parents have PhDs in English, so we have books all over the entire house, lining every wall. So, I mean, I was brought up with books around me and writing. But, you know, when your parents are something, you don't necessarily want to be what your parents are. So, in fact, you probably want the opposite. So
opposite.
I'm, like, fighting
that. Were they shocked?
And so I go and I work for the Daily Cal. I'm working at this radio station. I'm taking a journalism class. And then I realized, wow, in order for me to go into journalism, I'm going to have to go to the middle of nowhere and go to a small town. And I don't want to do that. I want to stay in a big city. So I had to go and do something that I hated in order to realize how much I really wanted to do that. So I worked PR for 2 years for a cruise line, and just really felt like it was not an ethical place for me, and I didn't want to be there, and it just felt wrong because they only tell one side of the story. It's all about positive spin, right? So I applied to journalism school, and I ended up going to Northwestern, ended up in the Washington program, and then I was on fire, and I was just like, wow, this is so cool. But I was totally in over my head in Washington, D.C. as a beginning reporter. That's where you go when you're, you know, journeyman. You have a lot of years under your belt. I was thrown into the mix. It was just so exciting, and I felt so important. I had to go get a job, and I really did end up going to a small town in the middle of nowhere, and then I worked my way back to the city, and it took a long time. I had to write a lot of really stupid stories about parades and art shows and silly, you know, things that happen on a Saturday, the county fair. You know, I did my share of those silly stories, and then slowly but surely got to City Hall and started writing the more political, more hard-hitting, and then I started getting into the investigative stuff, and I found out that I was just actually really good at it. So I continued to work on that, and on the side, I started going to writing workshops and working on fiction. I'm writing short stories, and over time, it took a long time, but I'm writing a novel on the weekends. I'm learning my investigative craft, and I'm learning, you know, nonfiction writing, and I basically meld them all together ultimately, and then that's when I quit the newspaper industry and I'm writing books full time. So
when
that's basically what I'm doing.
I love that you're doing something that you're passionate about. How did you pick your first book that you decided to write? What was the impetus for that topic?
Well, my first book that I wrote is not the first book that I got published. And when you go to writing conferences and you listen to these authors who have multiple books under their belts, many of them will tell you, mostly fiction authors, will tell you that they have, you know, four or five books in a drawer someplace. I was this crazy person who kept rewriting the same one. So it took me 17 years to get my first book that I ever wrote published. But the first book that I actually had published was a nonfiction book. So my first book that I wrote was fiction, was a mystery. It is called Naked Addiction. And I just I revised it and re-released it a couple of years ago by Wild Blue Press. And it takes place in La Jolla and PD. And I wrote it while I was working in Northampton, Massachusetts, homesick for La Jolla, where I grew up. So it's about a surfing detective who reads Albert Camus and the New York Times and wants to be a homicide detective, but he's actually an undercover narcotics detective and starts finding bodies and works on this case. And that's the one I was working on all the way along, but the first book that I actually got published was called Poisoned Love, and that was about an actual murder case that I covered for the San Diego Union-Tribune. I covered it from arrest to sentencing and also wrote a story for Cosmopolitan, and it's about a toxicologist for the county medical examiner's office who steals drugs from the lab and poisons her husband with it, and then stages a suicide scene and sprinkles red rose petals over his body to make it look like he killed himself because he was depressed that she was leaving him for her married boss.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, she was a meth addict, so she was basically going through, you know, when the investigators for the medical examiner's office go into death scenes, they pick up every drug they can find, recreational drugs and prescription drugs, and they get them all out of the house, and they, you know, bring them back to the office in the lab, and they catalog them and try to decide, you know, were these drugs, was it obvious, like somebody shot someone? If not, you know, they go through the drugs and do blood tests and all that kind of good stuff. That's what she did. And a lot of times they bring in white or yellow powder, which in San Diego is usually methamphetamine. And so here she was pulling glass pipes out of this inventory, you know, that these investigators were collecting, and she was in charge of the logbook, so she knew where everything was. So here she is pulling out the glass pipe, pulling out the powder, going into the room where she worked this machine, which had a vent on it, just like you have over your stove, and you hit the fan,
oh my gosh.
It sucks up the fumes. She's literally smoking meth in the mess in the medical examiner's office, and they know this because they found this glass pipe in the drawer of the machine with her DNA on the pipe. So it was just insane. And so she stole fentanyl from the lab, which is 100 times stronger than morphine, and she gave him some other sedative first, and then she gave him the fentanyl. So there you go.
Oh, my God. Okay, we're halfway through the show. Believe it or not, everybody, we have Caitlin Rother here, New York Times bestselling author. We have not even broached the topic, and no one can have her. We have so much that I want to talk to her about. We're going to take a quick commercial break to give Caitlin just a real quick opportunity to take a sip of water or something like that, and we'll be back after this message from It Matters Radio. And stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, first of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
Hey, wonderful people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, a duff man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, Letty, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be...
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
Well, that's a mouthful if I have a hard one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
I love that promo for It Matters Radio because Ken and Monica are listeners to the show, but they've also had lots of our guests on their program. So I always encourage you to go check them out. They do something off of Spreecast. So they actually do kind of a video chat, and it is really interesting to participate in that. So if you get a chance to go check them out, please do so. They've also got a little ad that runs through the the banner advertising that's going through here today. We are joined today by Caitlin Rother, New York Times bestselling author. By the way, if you're watching the show, as many of you are today from your computer, I've hyperlinked Caitlin's name on the show page, and that will take you directly to her Amazon author page. I'm a big fan of supporting our guests who are on the show, and if you happen to go there, I always say buy 10 of each. So you've got one copy for yourself and then 9 to give away as gifts throughout the rest of the year. And you'll make Caitlin happy. You put a couple of dollars in her pocket. And then also you'll have great friends and family, you know, giving you great gifts at Christmas or whatever holidays you like because you've given them the gift of reading. Caitlin, that brings up, I want to go and start talking about what it was like when you got your first book in your hand, but where do you prefer to have your fans and readers go purchase your stuff? Do you have a preference on your website, Amazon, other locations?
For the novel that I just mentioned, Naked Addiction, I actually would prefer if people went directly to Wild Blue Press because it helps them, it helps me, to Amazon too, but it's better for the, they're an indie publisher, they're small and they need, we're trying to showcase, the authors who are on this indie thing, who are in my same position, by the way, a number of people who are established authors who just haven't been able to really make a serious living the way we would like to, are trying the indie route because the royalties are higher, but it's a tough road to go. So all the help we can get, Wild Blue Press. I've got some Kindle shorts that are available on my Amazon page. You actually can't get those in the store, so you have to go there. A Complicated Woman and The Fugitive with One Shoe. I've got another one coming out soon. These are compilations of crime stories, but they're shorter. So they're not book length, they're shorter. And that's where you get those. And then other than that, I don't really care. But some of the books are – I mean, I don't care if you can get them on Amazon or you get
just
them
get
in the
them.
Store, but just get them. There are a few that are out of print, and if anybody is interested in any book that they can't find in paperback, they can contact me directly because I do autographed copies and send them through the mail if somebody contacts me and makes a special request.
And you can go to CaitlinRother.com.
No, it's C. Rother, the letter C, R-O-T-H-E-R, @flash.net is my email address. But yes, CaitlinRother.com is my website, and then my address is on there. Sorry, I was not thinking what you were saying.
No, that's okay. Can I ask a question here? You have these new shorter
–
I've got my dogs barking here. I don't know what the heck is going on.
They're
you have written
– listen to me.
Well, they're like, be quiet. Caitlin's on the air. Okay, so – for example, A Complicated Woman, South Carolina, Notorious USA. It's a shorter book. You said that you have written in lieu of doing a longer format novel. Are you writing those for any particular reason? And it's a leading question because, you know, we hear a lot of these millennials who can't carry on a conversation and can only, you know, text and chat, and they've got the attention span of a gnat. Are you writing for different audiences?
That's the reason I'm doing this. Greg Olson is a big true crime writer. He's on the New York Times bestseller list, sometimes for two books at once. And this is his theory. So he's got his own imprint, essentially. He's like his own indie publisher. And we have we share the same publisher, Kensington, for some of the books that he writes. And, you know, he gave me a couple blurbs on some of my books, really nice guy. And this is his theory that he has people, other authors like me, do these shorts. And so he's doing one per state. It's the Notorious USA series. And each author gets three states at a time. And these are my first three, South Carolina, Georgia, and the one that's about to come out is Florida. And I just thought, you know, I'm trying to diversify. I'm trying to, you know, all different types of income streams. And to be honest, I wrote 10 books and I kind of hit a wall, and I wanted to just kind of go back to my roots at the newspaper where, you know, you're writing a story, two stories a day. Later, as I got, you know, more an investigative reporter, I took longer and longer to write stories. But I miss having something come out more often because books are hard. Books are really hard. They're very, I am a super intensive researcher, and it takes a long time and a tremendous amount of energy to finish a book. I just kind of wanted a break, and I wanted a thing, and I really enjoy doing these. So I have three cases or four cases per state. And so some of them are historical, and it's been really fun to do a different type of story because, you know, the publisher that I have written the most books for, they want very, very recent cases. And so there's a lot of stuff that falls through the cracks that I'm interested in, but it doesn't fit what they want. So this gave me an opportunity to do stories about cases that were old, that were new, that were, you know, not new enough to make a whole book and not maybe big enough to do a whole book. Some of them are, but it was just really a nice thing for me to be working on for 6 months or 8 months while I'm waiting for some other cases to come to court, because I don't write about them unless there's a conviction. And I just, you know, I just kind of wanted to take a break. But, yeah, I think I'm getting a lot of the same readers, though, that have read my other books. But hopefully there are people out there who want to read something shorter and don't want to read a whole book, because they're not book length. They are short. So somewhere between, you know, 16 and 22,000 words, somewhere in there
I think that for me, I've got that attention span, so I need to go get that and order that. So thank you for doing
that.
It's
like a magazine. It's like a magazine length story per, you know, three magazine length stories. So if you read a Vanity Fair article or whatever, like three or four of those in the longest story in the magazine.
It's so you don't have time to get bored.
Right.
I love that.
No, not me. Never.
So when you first, you know, when you had your first book published, I know you, the Poison Love, I think you said was the book that came out first, even though you wrote Naked Addiction and spent years, you know, rewriting that same book. What was it like when you first got that copy in your hands after spending all of that time, you know, putting the words on a piece of paper and the computer? What was it like when you first got the book?
Poison Love?
Or Naked Addiction? Either one, but it's the thrill of, you know, having your hard work now finally in your hands.
Two different feelings. One for Poison Love, because it was my first book ever. I can't tell you what that was like. It was just tremendous joy. I mean, I remember I did a book launch party. It was one of the best nights of my life, because it was like reaching this goal that I had been trying to. It took me 15 years to get a book published, a book, any book. That's a long time to be trying. Trying to find an agent, rewriting something, thinking to myself, maybe this is just a vanity exercise. Maybe I'm never going to get published. Maybe I'm just crazy, you know, and doubting myself. And then seeing something positive and going, nope, I can't give up. Nope, that just happened. And I'm still doing that today. So And then Naked Addiction, because it took 17 years to finally get that published, and because it was the first book that I ever wrote, that was a whole other feeling. That was a tremendous feeling also. And two different types of books, fiction and nonfiction, are very different. So, but, you know, having a book in your hand, regardless of whether it's the first time or the 10th time, it's still, it's such a feeling of accomplishment because you've poured so many hours and so much grueling time, and there's always some kind of crisis with every book. There's some issue, there's some traumatic hurdle that you have to get over, no matter, sometimes it's, you know, a difficult source, sometimes it's people who protest at your book signing, sometimes it's,
wow,
you know, sometimes it's somebody says, oh, I don't want to talk to you anymore, and you're like, you know, halfway done with the book, and you know, there's always something.
So do you... As somebody who's written professionally for 19 years, when you get ready to go do a book, maybe the process is the same, I don't know. But when, let's say, you know, you've written Naked Addiction, I know you said you rewrote it a million times. How open were you after the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth revision to criticism or people saying, you know, you need to redo this again, or you need to take out another 10,000 words, or you need to add another 10,000 words, and you're like, every word is perfection. I can't imagine changing a single word of this, but then you do. What's that like as somebody who's spent your career as a writer being told, no, you've got to completely do this over?
Well, I mean, working as a newspaper reporter, you've got to develop a thick skin. And people who go into journalism and people who become editors, they're not always nice people. And they just tell you like it is. So, I mean, I had plenty of criticism all the way through. And you have to be, you have to take criticism. And nobody writes something perfect the first time. I don't care who it is. Nobody. You know, and so and I know who has really had, that I can think of right off the top of my head, Ann Patchett. She just has had this golden life. She wrote her, I think, very first short story ever, sent it to the Paris Review, got it accepted. Very first book she ever wrote, boom. Yeah, very first book she ever wrote, got it accepted. First try, first time out. I mean, that is like such the exception that I can't tell you. And she's very talented, and she's one of my favorite writers. But in general, most people need, I mean, I teach this in my classes. Writing is rewriting, and you can't think your stuff is perfect first time out. And I can't tell you how many times that I have had people in my classes or workshops that they think an hour and a half of my workshop is going to be enough for them to go write a book. I have to hold my tongue. I try to be nice, but it's like total delusion. It's like, come on. I'm a professional writer, and it took me 15 years to get a book published. And I'm a professional writer. And there are people who say, well, I've never published anything, but I've written lots of reports. You know, I've written technical reports, or I've written, you know, I'm a consultant, or I do this, or I'm a lawyer.
Completely different.
Or,
right.
Yeah, and it's totally, totally different. I mean, and I say, well, do you have any scenes in there? What do you mean? I'm like, okay, well, gee, then you've got a lot of work to do. You need to learn how to write a scene. What's a scene?
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay, see? We got a problem. So there are a lot of people out there who don't seem to accept that. And that's what it takes us back to the beginning of the conversation with all the people who didn't learn their craft and are flooding Amazon with the 99-cent book.
Well, I think there's a big lesson to be had there. We've got only about 15 minutes left in the show, which seems like a long time, but we have so much to cover, and I want to make sure that we give lots of credit here to then no one can have her. So, Caitlin, I'm going to, even before the show is over,
we need to have you back,
so we'll figure that out later
awesome.
On.
That's awesome. Can I just segue into something?
Please.
Can I just say one thing before I forget? The whole thing about learning your craft, I just want to mention I'm giving an all-day writing salon. It's called the Beach House Writing Salon. It's on April 30th, and it's an intensive, very intimate, full day. We've got four speakers, three best-selling authors, and one three-time Pulitzer-winning editor. And we are giving seminars, and we'll have a panel discussion, and we're doing one-on-one critiques. And it is in Cardiff, which is in North County of San Diego, and we moved it to the North County. So I was trying to draw more people from Orange County to come down. It's from 9 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night. We end the day with a cocktail party out on the deck with a beautiful view. And it's just a really great day, and it's very small. So I still have some seats left, and I wanted to make sure to mention that because it's a day where people can learn a lot and cram it all into one day, and people have had a really great experience with this, and I've learned a lot, and by the end of the day, you feel totally supercharged and ready to go attack a book project.
Now,
so if anybody is interested, please email me.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question is, how do people sign up for the Beach House Writing Salon on April 30th?
They have to email me, but if they want some more specific information, they can go to beachhousewritingsalon.blogspot.com. And it's a website dedicated just to this, and it tells about all the bios of the speakers and details on the seminars that we're going to be giving on developing strong characters, interviewing and research, editing, and narrative structure.
Now, do people need to be really accomplished in order to attend, or can novice like me sign up and say, okay, I'm going to come on down and learn lots?
Absolutely. Novices are welcome.
Okay. Is there any truth to the rumor that I hear that at the end of the Beach House Writing Salon on April 30th that you might actually grace the attendees with a song or two?
Maybe. When did you hear that?
I heard somewhere that you're a singer.
I have been singing, yes. Yes, I'm in a musical ensemble. It's called Breaking the Code.
Ooh.
We offer a full-bodied blend of classics and originals with notes of folk and jazz and blues and rock. And it's eclectic.
You guys have a CD out yet?
Not yet. We're working on it.
Okay. Well, when you have the CD out, I want to book you for the Friday night dance party, and we'll come on and we'll sell some CDs that night. So that would be really fun.
Ooh,
yay.
That would be fun.
So let's spend the rest of our time today. Well, I'll talk about anything you like, but I want to talk about Then No One Can Have Her, this murder out of Prescott, Arizona.
Okay.
I am shocked reading this book, and I know that you talked a little bit about it, and I think you actually even did a reading at SCWA back in January. I think that's when you were speaking, and I was sitting here going, I know Prescott, Arizona. I know this, and why, everything about it was shocking. So can you tell us a little bit about Then No One Can Have Her?
Sure. It's about a murder case. The victim is named Carol Kennedy. She was a mother of two daughters. She was an artist and a therapist, and she counseled domestic violence victims, ironically, ended up becoming one. So her husband of 25 years, Steve DeMocker, they met, they thought they were soulmates, and fell in love, got married, and he was working on a PhD, she was working on a master's degree. They ended up coming out to California. He was working at Patagonia, and he ended up losing his job because he was apparently having an affair with one of his coworkers, which was against company policy. They ended up moving to Prescott, Arizona, where he actually had gone to college, and he was hired as a sociology professor, and Carol starts teaching there as well. She's teaching yoga, psychology, dream work. She was a kind of a new age type person and had these amazing relationships with her students who thought that she was really a guru of this stuff. She just had these people fawning over her. She was very pretty. She had been a model when she was a teenager. She's very smart and just a gentle spirit and, like the bright light in the room. And so over the years, though, Steve is just having more and more affairs. And Carol gets to the point where she can't even talk to her friends about it, her girlfriends about it, because she doesn't know which ones of them have slept with her husband. He's sleeping with students. He's sleeping with nannies. He's sleeping with the midwife for their second child, apparently, while Carol is still pregnant with the second child. I mean, the guy is just a cad. And the thing is, though, that he had this way about him that he would keep saying he was sorry, he would cry, he would say he was going to stop, and he just never did. And one of the people that he had an affair with, and actually his longest affair outside of the marriage, was with his assistant, who later became more like a business associate. He moved into investment brokering. And so he went from being, you know, a cheater with women to being corrupted by power of, you know, being on the campus and becoming a dean. He became one of the nation's youngest deans. And he became known for being a manipulative, power-seeking kind of guy. And he moved into the finance world, and then he became corrupted by money. And he continued to cheat, and he continued to cheat on Carol, but also spending money like crazy. He was spending more money than he was earning. And he was earning quite a bit at one point before the 2008 bout with the market. He was earning like $500,000 a year.
Wow.
So
in Prescott, Arizona.
Is,
so, you know.
And that's not an expensive place to live either. So anyway, he's cheating, and she knows it. And she's like, you know, you're a sex addict. You need to get some help. And he says, yes, I admit, I know I have a problem. But he just wouldn't go, and he wouldn't get the help. He continued to cheat. He moves out, gets his own condo, and says, oh, I really just need a place to sleep because the dogs are barking too loud. The girls won't let me sleep. I have to get up so early to get up with the market, blah, blah, blah. No, he wants to go have sex with his mistress, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they're separated. Eventually, they're going through a divorce. It's a horrible divorce. It's acrimonious as all get out. He won't give her any money. She's like, you know, doesn't have enough money to buy a cup of coffee for herself. Meanwhile, he's spending money traveling around, having sex with different women he's meeting online. And he's, you know, got three women at a time. They all think that they're his girlfriend. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. And then the divorce is final. 35 days later, boom, she's found beaten to death. Her skull is fractured into more than 50 pieces.
Mm.
And the injuries, according to the medical examiner, were from a golf club. So what the police think is that Steve rode his bike over to the house, came up the trails behind the house where, you know, he used to live, and parked the bike, basically climbed over the fence, came inside, waited inside the house while she was out on a run, and then kind of came up to her while she was on the phone talking to her mom and beat her to death. And it was a horrible beating. And then the killer also moved things around. It was clear that the ladder in the room was facing the wrong way and didn't have any blood on it. In the spatter pattern, it clearly should have had blood on it. So the police thought initially maybe it was an accident. She fell because there were bookcases that were toppled over. So he basically moved the stuff around and made it look like an accident or a robbery or something. That they they realized pretty quickly that was not the case. Anyway, he then getting crazy and, you know, talking about leaving and going to Mexico and started buying all this stuff. Anyway, he gets arrested. He's behind bars. And then the story continues. I mean, it's a very long and convoluted story, but that's the basic part of the murder. There are a whole bunch of other parts to this story, which would take like another half an hour to talk about in detail. So I'll let you ask.
Well, I want people to go buy the book. So that should wet their whistle. So I'll tell you, Caitlin, one of the things that I like about your writing style in this particular book is that you are really painting the book with facts of here's exactly what happened, but you write the facts in such a way that, you know, you are really compelled to turn that page from page one to two to, you know, and as you cycle your way through the book. And I'm surprised, I think, in reading this, that it is so factual, and there's not like a lot of opinion writing in here. And I was expecting maybe a little bit more of that. Is that representative of the style?
That's representative of my style.
Okay.
There are some true crime authors who put all kinds of opinion or put some opinion in at the end or put it all the way through. I purposely try to keep my opinion out of it. And you can tell sometimes what I may think, or you may guess what I think based on details I include or how I, you know, create the scene and what dialogue that I include. And I mean, I think you get my message in a show don't tell kind of way by the time you're done with the book, which is, you know, good. I try to that's what I teach. That's supposed to be good writing. That's what I try to do. I was trained as an objective journalist. I have actually gotten more comfortable with putting more of myself into the book as I've written more and more books, but it's still it's hard for me to do. And, you know, if somebody says, do you think this convicted killer actually did the murder, I always say I don't talk about that. And people get upset with me. Well, why not? I say, for the reasons I just stated. And I also don't want people to read bias into the book. I wasn't there. I don't know exactly what happened, but here's all the evidence, and here's what I do know, and here's what the investigators think. And, you know, Steve DeMocker claims he's innocent. His whole family, his parents and his siblings think he's wrongly convicted. So he has an appeal pending, and I always mention that. And I always mention that it bothers me to this day that they never found any physical DNA or blood evidence tying him to that scene. So there you have it.
There we have it.
There's plenty of other evidence that was presented and he was convicted. Otherwise, I don't write the book. But there are other
so books. Do you have anything as a writer that just still even surprises you today as you dive into a project?
You know, it's the thing about it that's it's fun. It's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. And so it's fun for me to have my own questions answered. And I know there are certain things that readers will want to know. But I mean, I try to tell a good tale, you know, and I purposely do try to keep you turning pages. And so it reads like a suspense thriller, but it has to be absolutely positively, completely factual. I do not make anything up. I do not assume or create or embellish or exaggerate anything.
So how long of a process is this information gathering? Is it like an afternoon up at the Prescott Library or, I mean,
no.
I mean, obviously,
oh my God.
But you know, how long does it take you to put this together?
It varies. It varies from book to book. Dead Reckoning, the one I mentioned at the very beginning with Skylar and Jennifer DeLeon, I spent 5 years on that book, and I will probably never make money back on that. But I do have an update of that book coming out, by the way, with 20 new pages, because Skylar DeLeon, one of the motives for committing the murder of Tom and Jackie Hawks was to get money for a sex change operation that he already had scheduled and
had
put down a $500 deposit. Skylar has now transitioned to a woman, at least hormonally. She wants to be called she. She has been taking hormone treatment and still wants that sexual reassignment surgery. And California has now adopted a policy that allows prisoners like Skylar, other transgender prisoners, to apply for the surgery, and it would be taxpayer subsidized, and there's a whole bunch of criteria. I'm not sure she's going to qualify, but that's what the update is about, largely. So, you know, some of these stories keep going. That took 5 years, and then I spent like another year to do the update because I ended up doing a magazine article as well for Orange Coast Magazine. So you have to stay up on all of these, the development to keep it going, and also to do re-releases so I can stay a published author. It's always good to have new developments on these cases when there's appeals or when there are other things that happen. Sometimes there aren't things, but sometimes there are. Same thing with Poison Love. I did a re-release on that with also 20 new pages. So I'm always on the lookout to see if there's anything new.
There we go. Everybody, Caitlin, our time is up. I can't even believe it. The hour has flown by so quickly. I'm bowing at you. I'm so grateful that you spent your hour with us today. For everybody else that's listening, make sure to click that link, hyperlink on Caitlin's name right there on the show page. It'll take you to her Amazon page to go buy her books. But, of course, you can go to her publisher, which is Wild Blue Press. Go check that out for Naked Addiction. There's an update on that. And support independent artists. Regardless, if they're authors, musicians, filmmakers, whatever the case is, we need your support, and we love it when we have great entertainment like that. No one can have her that Caitlin's shared with us today. Hope to have her back very, very soon. Tomorrow night again, 7 o'clock, Zoe Niklaus and Doug Johnston for a 90-minute psychic astrology extravaganza, and our phone line's open at 6:45, so please call in early for that. And as always, it's my pleasure to do this with and for you. If you have somebody you'd like to have on the show, let me know who they are, and we'll get them booked for later this year. And Caitlin, thanks again for being here, and I can't wait to have you back. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much. This was great. I really enjoyed it.
Yay. Okay. Everybody have a great night. Don't drive distracted, and enjoy the rest of your night.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.